All righty. The first regathering, Modern Israel, starting session 12 on page 102 of your notebook. So let's do a little review of where we were. We're in the third major section of the study, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947. Last week, we witnessed Field Marshal Edmund Allenby start his thrust in World War I into Palestine. The Egyptian Expeditionary Force secured the south by capturing Beersheba. They then moved up the coast and secured the coast by capturing Jaffa. And so the way was open for the final thrust into Jerusalem. And the invasion went very well. Allenby then entered Jerusalem on foot. He got off his horse and entered into the holy city in humility, not to come as a proud conqueror, but as a liberator. Last week, we then talked about the importance of World War I to the nation of Israel and in eschatology. And the importance of World War I is brought out in Matthew 24, verse 3, and verses 7 and 8. And it was up on the Mount of Olives that the disciples asked him three questions. The most important question we looked at last week was, what is the sign of the end of the age? What is the sign of the end of the age? And we explored Yeshua's answer to that, and we learned that the answer to the question was this: when you see a world war, that is a sign of the end of the age. So World War I marked the beginning of the birth pangs, the beginning of the end of the age, and we have been in the last days since 1914. So World War I and also World War II, by the way, are very important in regard to the modern state of Israel and the last days. The world was marching toward the San Remo Peace Conference at last week. World War I had come to a close. And at that point in time, nobody opposed the Balfour Declaration. President Wilson, for example, said, "So far, I have found no one who is seriously opposing the purpose for which it," speaking of the Balfour Declaration, "embodies." Everybody was happy with the Balfour Declaration then, including Weizmann and Faisal. Faisal, the Hashemite leader, and Weizmann got together. They created the Weizmann-Faisal Accord. Everybody was buddy-buddies and supporting each other regarding Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism. Everybody was on the same page at the beginning, but it soon went sour. We also returned our attention to Joseph Trumpeldor again. Remember, he went back to Russia, and he began the Chalutzim movement, the pioneer movement. After the Chalutzim movement got started, he then returned to Israel only to die at Tel Hai. Now, as San Remo approached in 1920, the French and the British hammered out the borders of the area allocated for the Jewish national home. And this was Palestine then. This became the official borders of Palestine. This was part of the British mandate. Iraq was part of the British mandate. Syria was part of the French mandate. But this was the area to be given to the Jews for the Jewish national home. Well, the Zionists looked at that area and they said, "We really don't want all of that. Please just give us our traditional historical borders. Just give us our historical borders. That's the only area we want." Well, the French didn't like the northern borders, and so they bickered with the British over it. And the decision was to divide the mandated area up. And we'll talk more about this later on. And so kind of a setback for the Zionists, but so all the land west of the Jordan River now became Palestine, and the land east of the Jordan River now became Transjordan. So the area for the Jewish home was cut down. We'll talk about that decision a little more later on today. Sir Herbert Samuel, a Jew and a Zionist, was appointed the High Commissioner, and he was obsessed with fairness. He didn't want to be accused of being unfair and biased because he was a Zionist and a Jew. And so his obsession with fairness pretty soon degraded into appeasement. And he gave in to a lot of Arab demands, and his appeasement only caused the Arab nationalists to become more and more restive. So while he was a good commissioner, he went overboard trying to keep the Arabs happy. There was a riot in 1920 in Jerusalem, and that riot spread outside of Jerusalem. It became apparent that the Yeshuv would have to defend itself in its entirety. No more would defense be limited to individual kibbutzim, individual farms, the way HaShomer had been guarding the kibbutzim and the farms. And so the Histadrut formed the Haganah, Israel Defense, that would become the Israel Defense Forces, the Haganah. General Yitzhak Sadeh was the first leader of the Haganah. And he developed the idea of an active defense. All right, that takes us now to page 102, and the National Assembly elected. Everybody there at the top of page 102? Okay, those that are following along, feel free. Okay, another important event that occurred in 1920 was the election of the Asefat HaNivcharim, the National Assembly, April 1920. Some 20,000 persons, 70% of the registered Jewish voters, participated in the voting. The newly elected National Assembly formally opened in Jerusalem in October of 1920. 314 members from 20 different parties. You think Israeli politics are bad today? How would you like to live in a country with 20 different competing parties, huh? Well, it got pared down over time. The first order of business was to elect the Va'ad La'umi, an executive board of 36 men and women. Sir Herbert Samuel, he's the mandatory high commissioner, impressed by this evidence of Zionist communal purpose, offered the National Assembly certain functional latitude over Jewish religious, cultural, and social welfare activities. So this is the embryonic beginnings of Jewish self-government in the land, the very, very beginnings. It's self-government is just being conceived at this time. All right, 1921 was the 12th Zionist Congress, and also in 1921 we had some more riots. And just a little bit of review. In 1920, there was that major Arab riot in Jerusalem. And during that year, Sir Herbert Samuel took up his position as British High Commissioner in Israel. His obsession with impartiality led to conciliatory gestures being extended to the Arabs. As I said, his obsession with fairness degraded into appeasement. And so this action only encouraged Arab nationalism, and Arab restiveness continued to grow. Now, renewed trouble began in Jaffa, May 1st, 1921, when a ragtag group of Jewish communists brashly marched through the center of town in the wake of a Zionist labor parade. The incident served the Arab nationalists as a pretext. They rioted, and the violence extended immediately to the countryside. Soon, Petach Tikva and other Jewish farms were besieged. By the time British troops finally suppressed the last attack at the end of the week, 47 Jews and 48 Arabs had been killed, several hundred others of both peoples wounded. Now, the riots in Jaffa emptied the port city of its Jewish inhabitants. The exodus of Jews from Jaffa tripled the population of that little suburb known as Tel Aviv to the north. The population of Tel Aviv jumped from 3,600 to over 10,000 because of that incident. Now, I have highlighted in your notes, in all caps, what we're going to start seeing now with this second riot. The Balfour Declaration had been incorporated directly into the San Remo Mandatory Award by Britain itself. But by late 1921, growing reservations were being expressed at the government's pro-Zionist policy. That highlights, that predicts what we're going to start seeing as this lesson continues. And the tables will be turned against Zionism in spite of the original intent of the Balfour Declaration. Remember, here's David Lloyd George. Remember what he said about the Balfour Declaration? He said, the notion that Jewish immigration would have to be artificially restricted in order to ensure that the Jews should be a permanent minority never entered into the heads of anyone engaged in framing the policy. So we're going to see now, keep your eyes open, I'm going to be talking a lot about Jewish immigration being restricted more and more and more and more. Totally in violation with what the framers of the Balfour Declaration had intended. So there's where we're going. There's where we're going. All right, Transjordan created. Here's more details on this division of the mandate. Now, in 1921, the British colonial secretary was Winston Churchill, and here's a picture of young Winston Churchill in 1918, just a couple of years before our remarks in the class. He's not smoking his stogie there, is he? No, there's a young Winston Churchill, the colonial secretary. In March of 1921, he journeyed to the Holy Land. Then and there, to Jew and Arab alike, he firmly repeated his support for a Jewish national home. Yet, notice that word, yet. Yet his tour resulted in the separation of Transjordan from Palestine and a reclarification of the Balfour Declaration. With the end of the war, in 1918, World War I was over in 1918, the entire region east of the Jordan River was vaguely included in the Arab sphere of influence. Emir Faisal made no attempt to administer the area. But in the summer of 1920, Transjordan was reduced to a no man's land. And at that time, Emir Abdullah appears on the scene. He's Sheriff Hussein's oldest son. So here he is. Emir Abdullah shows up in Transjordan. In March of 1921, T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, and Churchill revived an idea they had discussed earlier. They would ask Abdullah to stay in Transjordan, where he could reign, although not technically rule, he could reign for Britain. They liked that idea. So Churchill immediately cabled London and obtained its permission to make the offer. He and Abdullah met on May 26, 1921, and here is the offer to Emir Abdullah. Abdullah would establish an orderly government in Amman. That's the capital of Jordan today. He would establish his government in Amman. He would recognize Transjordan as an integral part of Britain's Palestine, and he would administer the territory in the name of the Mandate. And guess what? Abdullah accepted. He thus established an Arab government east of the Jordan River. So here's our area allocated for the Jewish national home in 1920. The proposal is made to Abdullah. He accepts. And so Great Britain divides the mandated area. Everything to the west of the Jordan River is now Palestine. Everything to the east of the Jordan River is now Transjordan, both under the British mandate. And so the area set aside for an Arab national home, Transjordan, now covers approximately 75% of the British mandated area there. And the area set aside for the Jewish national home, Palestine, now covers about 25% of the original area set aside for the Jewish people. So the area for a Jewish national home has been whacked down by three quarters, by 75%. Okay, make sense? Made 1921 to 1923, the division of the mandate. So the establishment of an Arab government east of the river was Britain's first explicit admission that Transjordan was included in the Arab zone, in the zone of Arab autonomy, I should say. So in Britain's thinking, restrictions, notice that word, restrictions were slowly being placed upon the Jewish national home. Again, in violation of the spirit of the Balfour Declaration. Here it goes. The stone has been released and it's now rumbling downhill. All right, the beginning of Jewish industry, middle of the page there. The 1920s witnessed the beginning of Jewish industry in Palestine. In 1921, a brick factory was constructed in Tel Aviv. The same year, a Russian Jewish engineer, Pinchas Rutenberg, obtained a concession from the mandatory government to build the first electric power station in Tel Aviv. And from then on, private Jewish capital steadily established industries of every stripe. And so Israel today is a combination of socialism and capitalism. It's kind of a wedding the two systems together. All right, 1922, worked a Churchill White Paper. In 1922, still other, there's your key word, restrictions. Other restrictions were imposed upon the Jewish national home. In May 1922, Herbert Samuel returned to London to impress on the colonial office the need for dispelling Arab fears on the Palestinian question once and for all. This could be accomplished only by, quote, a definitive interpretation of the Balfour Declaration. That was his insistence. His recommendation was accepted. So a statement of policy was drafted mainly by Herbert Samuel himself, the Jewish Zionist, for issuance over Churchill's signature. And at this time, I want to show you that classic picture of Sir Winston Churchill. You have his portrait on page 104. But there's when we see Winston Churchill, that's the guy we think of, isn't it? The guy chomping on the stogie, huh? So this is issued over Churchill's signature. He was the colonial secretary. Known afterward as the Churchill White Paper, the document, there's that word again, restricted the Jewish national home to the area west of the Jordan. It avoided the notion of creating a predominantly Jewish state, and it limited Jewish immigration to the economic capacity of the country. See where it's going? The stone is rolling downhill, and it's starting an avalanche. In stating that immigration should not exceed Palestine's absorptive capacity, the mandatory government adopted a system of issuing permits by categories, such as laborers, farmers, capitalists, and others. Now, the restrictions impose no severe hardship on Jewish immigration during the early years of the mandate. What was ominous, however, for the Zionists was the precedent established for conceivably more drastic limitations in the future. Now, the draft was submitted to the Zionist organization in June. Fearful of losing British support altogether, Weizmann and the Zionist executive signed the document. What did the Arab delegation do? The Arab delegation, on the other hand, rejected it outright. Has anything changed? No. Nothing has changed.
They rejected it because they were going back on the promise to Israel.
They rejected it because they didn't want, we'll talk about it here in just a second, because they didn't want a Jewish national home. Now, the mixed reception notwithstanding, the government published the Churchill White Paper July 1st, 1922 as, note, the official interpretation of the British mandate in Palestine. It should be the official reinterpretation of the Balfour Declaration. Now, here is that document, the White Paper, the Churchill Memorandum, the Churchill White Paper, and you can see the heading for it, British Policy in Palestine. That was the key to it. Now, we're going to take a look at this particular paragraph right here. Now, I'm not going to force you to read it. I'm going to reproduce that for you, okay? That's a lazier on your eyes, right? Here's what that particular paragraph said. The tension which has prevailed from time to time in Palestine is mainly due to apprehensions which are entertained both by sections of the Arab and by sections of the Jewish population. These apprehensions, so far as the Arabs are concerned, are partly based upon exaggerated interpretations of the meaning of the Balfour Declaration, favoring the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine, made on behalf of His Majesty's government on the 2nd November 1917. Unauthorized statements have been made to the effect that the purpose in view is to create a holy Jewish Palestine. That's unauthorized. Phrases have been used such as that Palestine is to become as Jewish as England is English. By the way, Chaim Weizmann made that statement. Notice the final sentence I've highlighted for you. His Majesty's government regard any such expectation as impractical and have no such aim in view. In other words, we're not going to create a Jewish national home. That's the Churchill White Paper. That's a reinterpretation of the Balfour Declaration. Now, on this basis, too, the mandate won swift acceptance in the House of Commons 5 days later and by the League of Nations September 29, 1922. Now, the Zionists had suffered a reverse of sorts, but it wasn't a fatal one at this time. In the preamble to its mandatory award to Britain, after all, the League Council, one, had recited the Balfour Declaration almost verbatim. Secondly, they had alluded specifically to the historical connection of the Jewish people with Palestine. Thirdly, they alluded to the moral validity of reconstituting the national home in that country. Fourthly, they imposed on the British the obligation not simply to permit, but to secure a Jewish national home. And they expected the British to, quote, use their best endeavors to facilitate Jewish immigration and encourage Jewish settlement in the land. So now Britain and the League of Nations are getting at odds with each other. Now, in addition, Hebrew was recognized as the official language, and that must have pleased Eliezer Ben Yehuda to no end, right? He must have just smiled a big smile when he heard that. Now, a Jewish agency was authorized to cooperate with the mandatory in the development of natural resources and in the operation of public works and utilities. So note the next sentence. It was plain then, from the beginning to the end, that the League Award was framed to protect the Zionist redemptive effort. And so the British accordingly invested with full powers of legislation and administration, in which the obligation was imposed of ensuring self-government. Self-government obviously was not intended for the Holy Land on the basis of an obvious Arab majority. Now, it was significant, for example, that the word Arab did not once appear in the mandatory award, and that the Arabs and other nations in Palestine were repeatedly described as non-Jews. So page 105. Nor was there doubt that the British government intended to stand behind the mandate. The Bonner Law Cabinet, which succeeded Lloyd George in October of 1922, firmly rejected every Arab effort to alter Britain's support of Zionism and the Jewish national home. A law, therefore, upon which the mandatory administration based its functional activities was signed by the King in London on August 10, 1922, and proclaimed by Sir Herbert Samuel in Jerusalem on September 1. This was known as the Palestine Order in Council. And by the way, I want you to scratch out that word in and make it of Council. It's of Council. Okay. It should not be of Council. It should be in Council. I have learned just recently that there's a distinction in British law between something that is in Council and something that is of Council. So this is the Palestine Order in Council, apparently. Just to make that just a little British law technicality there. I hope I've done it correctly. Now, it included the traditional provisions of freedom of worship, liberty of conscience, and Britain's responsibility to foster the Jewish national home. Sir Herbert Samuel did not hesitate to use his powers of legislation extensively. With its 9,000 square miles, Palestine was divided now into three districts, North, South, and Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem functioned both as the headquarters of his own district and the capital of the mandatory government. So my point here is that Britain is schizophrenic at this time. They are conflicted over the issue of a Jewish national home. On one side, they want to appease the Arabs and not have any Jewish national home. On the other side, they want to keep the League of Nations happy and produce a Jewish national home. So we're going to see this British schizophrenia, this British confliction continue on for year after year after year. All righty, I've got about a quarter till, so why don't we take our break, and we'll pick up in 15 minutes, we'll pick it up at the operation of the mandate. So listen for the shofar and be back in about 15 minutes. So go ahead and take your break. Alrighty, let's pick it up again on the operation of the mandate, middle of page 105 in your notebook. We've seen that Britain is now conflicted and quite schizophrenic over the issue of a Jewish national home, but they did have a mandate to administer. So let's take a look at how they did that. When Britain assumed responsibility for the Holy Land, it took over an economic cripple. Britain's initial efforts in Palestine during the first 2 years of the occupation were devoted simply to restoring a minimal degree of law and order. Perhaps the Mandatory's single most impressive accomplishment was the establishment of an honest and efficient judiciary, a system of courts, a court system. The Mandatory administration expended much effort and talent as well on fostering agriculture, a section of the economy that the Turks, the Ottomans, had ruinously neglected. The government's agricultural department established research stations for improving cultivation and livestock. With this help, the ravages of cattle plague, locusts, and fruit flies were markedly reduced. Wide-ranging improvements in communications were accomplished by enlarging the rail network, by building roads and bridges, and further modernizing and augmenting postal, telegraph, and telephone services. Air links were established with Europe and the rest of the Middle East, and an international airport was constructed at Lydda. And, of course, here's a picture of that airport. It would eventually become Ben-Gurion Airport. But here it is, 1936. You can see the airport under construction. The terminal has all this scaffolding around it. Can you see the scaffolding? So that's Ben-Gurion Airport under construction in 1936. And there's a Boeing 707 there. In the front, yeah. All right, that's Ben-Gurion then. This is Ben-Gurion now. So when you fly into Ben-Gurion, this is what you see now, a very modern, brand new airport. It's great. It's great. I went in there the first time, the old airport, and I was just bowled over when I went in and the new airport was functioning. Here is inside the terminal. So you guys that have been there, you remember that fountain that comes from the ceiling there? You see that? You guys can see that column? It's a column of water coming down, not a full column, just an edge. That's a fountain of water coming down out of the ceiling. So it's a great airport, very efficient, very organized, very pretty, very easy to get around. So the Ben-Gurion Airport has really improved over the years. All right, unquestionably, there was also shortcomings in the government scheme of administration. Now, the Jews complained that the Mandatory had virtually abandoned its legal and moral responsibility to foster the economic growth of the Jewish national home. The Arabs benefited most impressively from government expenditures. The departments of agriculture, public health, and education all concentrated heavily on the Arabs. These weaknesses and inequities notwithstanding, it soon became evident that the improvements wrought by Samuel's administration were light years beyond anything Palestine had ever known. Now, the High Commissioner himself completed his term of office in 1925, June 1925, page 106. In June 1925, the Hebrew University was inaugurated on Mount Scopus in Jerusalem with a visit from distinguished figures from abroad. And Allenby came from Egypt. Balfour came from England. And he was moved to tears by the evidence of the progress he saw everywhere around him. Now, writing in his final summary report for Parliament, Samuel could allude not merely to the organization of a civil police force and the gradual pacification of the country, the excellent legal system and public services. He could refer meaningfully as well to the spectacular rise of the Jewish population since 1917, from 55,000 to 103,000 by 1925. Now, much of this Jewish growth and progress was a result of the Zionist enterprise alone. Yet, the Zionist enterprise, benefited in measurable degree from a quality of peace, order, justice, and administrative integrity far superior to that provided by any neighboring government. So even though the British were not too eager to facilitate a Jewish national home, still, God used British skills to create the foundations for the modern state. Death of Eliezer ben Yehuda, 1922, December 16th, 1922, is when Eliezer ben Yehuda died, shortly after hearing the news that Hebrew would be the official language, recognized as the official language. Just a few months later, he was gone. It seems like his job was finished.
I got a question.
Question.
Was there any GDP numbers?
I don't know of any. There may have been. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if even GDP numbers were conceived of in those days. So I'd probably something, yeah. All right, 1923. Let's back up a few years again. 1923, the mandate was confirmed by the League of Nations. 1924, we come to the fourth Aliyah. In 1924, the population of the land was augmented by an unexpected and sizable influx of Polish Jews. The Polish government had nationalized those branches of industry, those branches of commerce, in which Jews were most heavily representative, and then they dismissed the Jewish employers and favored the Poles. As a result, fully a third of the nation's Jewish merchants were driven to bankruptcy, and emigration became their only hope. So in Poland in 1924, there was an economic pogrom. Not a physical pogrom like in the past, but this time an economic pogrom. So in 1924 to 1928, 70,000 of them made their way to Palestine. So the arrival of this fourth Aliyah, this fourth immigration wave, also included 8,000 Jews from the Caucasus and from the Middle East. Now, the fourth Aliyah raised the Jewish population in Palestine from 84,000 in 1922 to 154,000 in 1929. Now, these newcomers were rather different. Few of the newcomers were animated by labor Zionist or even agricultural ideals. That's what we've seen in the past, haven't we? Farming the land, creating the kibbutzim and the moshavim. The fourth Aliyah immigrants generally gravitated to the cities and the towns, where they set up duplicates of the enterprises that they left behind. It was the newcomers of the fourth Aliyah who laid the basis for the Yishuv's urban economy. Within 5 years, they doubled the Jewish population of Jerusalem and Haifa. By the same token, their immigration was largely responsible for making a city out of Tel Aviv. It was the influx of the fourth Aliyah that swelled Tel Aviv's population to 16,000 in 1924 and 46,000 by 1929, just a few years later. And from then on, growth produced its own momentum. Tel Aviv boasted 160,000 by 1939, all Jewish. Your next note at the bottom of the page, Technion opened in Haifa. I haven't said anything about Technion, but Technion is Israel's Institute of Technology. Here is their seal. And it took them a while to get going. The construction began on Technion in 1912. Here is a picture of the construction beginning in 1912. You can see the laborers working on one of the major buildings. Things hadn't gotten very far by 1913. The building was still far from finished by 1913. Then 1914, what happened? World War I. And everything came to a screeching halt for a while. And finally, Technion did get finished. And this is that building today. I believe it's a museum today on the grounds of the Technion. So the Technion finally opened in 1924, the Technical Institute. All righty. Let's move to the top of the page, page 107. 1925, we already mentioned this. Hebrew University in Jerusalem opened. A Hebrew university had been the dream fairly early on in the Zionist movement. Weizmann referred to such a dream as early as 1903. And the dream came to pass in June of 1925 with the inauguration of the school on Mount Scopus. Judah Magnus, an American-born Reform rabbi, became the first chancellor of the school. Here's some pictures for you. Here is the inauguration ceremony on the grounds of Mount Scopus. A lot of Jewish people gathered. Balfour was part of that. Again, he was moved to tears when he saw this all happening. So there's the beginning of Hebrew University. Here is the main entrance to Hebrew University today. And here's an overview of the campus. And you can spot Hebrew University quite easy because of the distinctive tower that juts up out of the middle of the campus. So there's Hebrew University on Mount Scopus today. Very, very well-known university. And of course, Arab and Jewish students both attend Hebrew University. Yes?
Is that where the famous hospital is where they do all the research and everything?
I'm not sure which one you're talking about. Okay, can't answer that question for you. Alrighty, 1927, the death of Ahad Ha'am. Remember, that's Asher Ginsburg. He died in 1927. Now, the roots of self-government. In July of 1927, the mandatory government issued an ordinance formally recognizing a single Jewish community, the Knesset Yisrael, with its own religious and secular organs. The religious organ was the Rabbinical Council that had already been functioning for a number of years. In the secular area, the National Assembly and its Va'ad Le'umi now were granted official status. For the Yishuv, these measures represented a limited but potentially important new avenue of self-government. So things are kind of gelling now in the area of Jewish self-government, from the Va'ad Le'umi to now its official status. 1929, Arab riots in Jerusalem. In 1929, Arab restlessness had continued to grow. As it happened, violence was ignited in a very unlikely location, the old city of Jerusalem, where Jews and Arabs had been living in close proximity for several centuries. There, abutting the Haram es Sharif complex of mosques, was the venerated Jewish Western Wall, remnant of the ancient temple. Now, the wall technically belonged to the Muslim community, but by tradition, a tradition extending back at least to the Middle Ages, the Jews enjoyed an easement to the strip of pavement facing the historic buttress and the right to prayer at the wall itself. Now, here are some pictures. Here is a drawing of the Western Wall in the 19th century. And you can see it's just a little strip, a little easement up against the Western Wall. This is not the temple itself. This is Herod's platform. This is the side of Herod's platform that he built to level out Mount Zion. And you can see a row of Herodian stones at the very bottom there with that boss around them. So a very narrow area that the Jews were allowed to pray at. Now, you see that little door down there? We'll walk down to that door in a few years, but we'll take a look at that. So there is a drawing, a very accurate drawing of the Western Wall. Now, here is a photograph of the Western Wall in 1870. Again, photography was just coming in at that time. And you can see again at the bottom of the page there that narrow easement, that narrow lane where the Jewish people were allowed to come and pray in contact with the Western Wall itself. And here is a picture of that little doorway that I spoke of. Well, again, we'll take another look at that doorway in just a moment. And here is a picture of Jewish women praying at the Western Wall at that time. Just a very casual and unsophisticated area of prayer for the Jewish people. Now, here's a picture of the Western Wall in 1934. There's that little doorway again. That's what I was pointing out. We're now down at the end of that easement. But in 1934, you can see the British policeman there keeping order, making sure no disturbances occur at the Western Wall. Now, here's the Western Wall today. That easement is gone. The old buildings have now been removed, and you have a huge plaza there in front of the Western Wall. Again, that is the Western Wall of the platform that Herod built to level out Mount Zion. And here is prayer at the Western Wall today. I took this picture from the, let me back up here. You see the platform going up to the Mughrabi gate there? I was standing at the far corner of that walkway and shot down at prayer at the Western Wall today. And then from the ground level again, prayer at the Western Wall is very much different than it was a number of years ago. So there's the Western Wall today. All right, in 1928, shortly before Yom Kippur, the Jewish sexton at the wall placed a screen on the flagstones to separate men and women according to Orthodox Jewish practice. Essentially, he was making that strip of land, that little easement, into a synagogue. Technically, that's what he was doing. The Arabs immediately complained that the status quo had been violated. The British authorities agreed, and they ordered the screen removed. The Jews complained, but to no avail. Subsequently, the entire yeshuv, religious and non-observant alike, expressed indignation at wanton interference with Jewish freedom of worship. The Zionist organization submitted protests to London. On the other side of the coin, the Arabs appealed to the Muslim world, charging that the Jews intended to seize control of the venerated Al-Aqsa Mosque within the Haram area. Has anything changed? It's still the same argument today, isn't it? At the initiative of the Mufti's Supreme Muslim Council, the Arab workers set about building operations. This is construction operations in the neighborhood of the wall, noisy construction operations to interfere with Jewish worship. An especially noisy Muslim religious ceremony was launched to disrupt Jewish prayers there. So months of protests and counter-protests followed. Everybody's getting into the argument here. On June 11, 1929, after prolonged evasiveness by the mandatory government, they didn't know which way to go either, they're so conflicted on this, and repeated consultations with the legal offices of the Crown, the High Commissioner notified the Mufti that Jews were entitled to worship without disturbance. Page 108. But the building operations might continue, provided quiet, no disturbances caused to Jewish worshipers during the customary times of prayer. So you can build there, but just keep the noise down. Well, neither the Jews nor the Muslims were satisfied with this decision. Nobody was happy. Now, on August 16th, a right-wing Jewish youth group sought permission to conduct a peaceful march on the wall. The British Acting High Commissioner, Sir Harry Luke, approved the youth group's request. Immediately, the Muslim leadership organized a turbulent counter-demonstration near the wall, delivering inflammatory speeches and provoking minor skirmishes. During the subsequent week, Muslim agitators traveled throughout the country, exhorting the peasantry to protect Al-Aqsa against Jewish attacks. Finally, in the night of August 23rd and the next morning, crowds of Arabs armed with weapons poured into Jerusalem. The newcomers gathered near the mosque courtyard to be harangued by the Mufti. And then at noon, an Arab mob attacked the Orthodox Jewish quarters and violence spread rapidly to other areas of Palestine. In the late afternoon, Arab bands descended on the Orthodox Jewish community of Hebron, murdering 67 and wounding 50 inhabitants of Hebron. Other assaults were carried out in Haifa and Jaffa, and even in Tel Aviv. Numerous Jewish agricultural villages were similarly attacked. The Royal Air Force had a contingent in Amman, Jordan, to the east of the Jordan River. But that Royal Air Force contingent was inadequate to restore order, and the Arab police were sympathetic with the rioters. The acting high commissioner was obliged to telephone Egypt for military assistance, but the main body of troops did not reach Palestine until 3 days later. And order was not restored until August 25, another 5 days later. By then, 133 Jews had been killed, 399 wounded. The Arabs had suffered 178 casualties, of which 87 had been killed. Now, the High Commissioner rushed back from England and issued a proclamation on September 1 that furiously condemned Arab atrocities. He then proceeded to levy heavy collective fines on Arab towns and villages. But the effect of these measures was soon dissipated. no sooner than the Mufti protested the High Commissioner's brutality that the High Commissioner issued a second proclamation a few days later, stating that an inquiry into the conduct of both sides would be held as soon as possible. In response, the Jews, appalled at the implication that the murderers and the victims were somehow on a common level, turned to London for redress. Page 109 now, we're at the Shaw Report. At this critical moment in the Yishuv's fortunes, the Zionists learned to their dismay that they no longer enjoyed the backing of a sympathetic government in England. Ramsay MacDonald was now the Prime Minister. The Colonial Secretary was Lord Passfield. So up on the screen, there is the new Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald. You have his portrait in your notebook. But I've also put up there Colonial Secretary Lord Passfield. His portrait is on the next page. So these are the two folks that the Zionists are now dealing with in the English government. Now, MacDonald had visited Palestine in 1922, and he returned declaring that British promises to Jews and Arabs were contradictory. Now, Weizmann soon discovered which way the wind was blowing upon reaching London. For the first time in his experience, the Zionist leader encountered a chill atmosphere, no longer warm. He was unable at the outset to secure an interview with Passfield. When Passfield finally received Weizmann, he bluntly declared himself opposed to mass Jewish immigration into Palestine. Again, counter to the Balfour Declaration. Other shocks were in store. The political ramification of the violence would continue for a year and a half, and it would encompass a torrent of controversy that threatened the very future of the Jewish national home. Now, in mid-September, the Colonial Office dispatched a royal commission to Palestine to inquire into the immediate causes that led to the recent outbreak in Palestine and make recommendation as to the steps necessary to avoid a recurrence. So this is Royal Commission number 2. You'll see this pattern over and over and over again. There's a disruption, and the British then send out an inquiry, a committee, to look into it. And that's not the way to deal with problems, with the committee. It doesn't get very far. But that's the way the British handled this. So this is the Royal Committee number 2. Now, the chairman of the commission was Sir Walter Shaw. The commission conducted its hearings over a period of 5 weeks and finally issued its report March 31st, 1930. It found the Arabs responsible for the violence. But notice how they waffle now. The commission went on to state that the fundamental cause of the tragedy was, quote, the Arab feeling of animosity and hostility towards the Jews subsequent upon the disappointment of their political and national aspirations and fear of their economic future. All right, so they're responsible, but here's the reasons why they're responsible. So what are we going to do about it? The mandatory administration was urged then, first of all, to tighten its control of Jewish immigration, and then to protect the Arab tenants from eviction by Jewish land purchasers, and to ensure that the Jewish agency understood henceforth that it was, and you can underline this or highlight it, the Jewish agency was in no sense empowered to share in the government of Palestine. All right, so this, how to solve this problem. One, limit Jewish immigration, limit Jewish land purchase, and limit Jewish government. In other words, they're throttling the Jewish national home, aren't they? They've got their hands on the throat of the nation, and they're squeezing as tight as they can.
Things haven't
changed that much, right. Except the British are now out of the picture, right? Yeah. The Shaw Report aroused consternation among the Zionists and, predictably, jubilation among the Arabs. What has happened here, you guys? The Arabs have been rewarded for violence.
Yeah.
Has anything changed?
No.
The Arabs were now rewarded for violence. Now, subsequent governmental measures intensified these reactions. On May 12, the colonial office instructed the mandatory to suspend the latest Jewish immigration schedule of 3,300 labor certificates. 2 weeks later, in a statement presented to the League Mandates Commission, the British government declared that it viewed the Shaw recommendations favorably and was considering additional measures for suspending Jewish immigration and for protecting the Arab population. So the Arabs need protection here from the nasty Jews. Page 110. Now, the League body didn't go along with this. Although the League body, for its part, rejected the contention that Arab rights could best be protected by limiting Jewish immigration and limiting land purchases, London nevertheless proceeded to explore further the recommendations outlined in the Shaw report. So again, England is now schizophrenic on this issue. They want to keep the League of Nations happy, they want to keep the Arabs happy, and they're two opposing problems. So England is going to waffle back and forth and back and forth over this for many, many years. All righty, well, I've got 4 minutes left, and the Passfield White Paper is the next subject, and that's a little too extensive to dive into for tonight. So we'll pick that up next week at the top of page 110 with the Passfield White Paper as we see England try to manage the mandate in a responsible way. Guess which way it's going to go? I'll leave that up to you. We'll look at that next week. All right, let me close in prayer, and then I'll turn you loose. 4 minutes early. How about that? We started a little late too. Yeah, that's amazing. Huh? Father, again, I want to thank you for your work in the world, and thank you for bringing along the Jewish National Home in spite of the opposition that is now generating step by step, more severe and more severe. Thank you for using the British mandatory government to improve the situation in the land called Palestine at this time, you know, with new roads and new bridges and airports and things like that, but at the same time saying that the Jewish community had no right to self-government. Quite a contradictory position to take. So Lord, we're glad that you're in charge, and no matter what happens, you see to it that your will is accomplished, and we know that you will do that in our lives as well. We might be involved in contradictions and all kinds of tough times, but we know that we need to trust you and trust your will for our lives and your will for this world. And we see that laid out before us as we look at this little bit of history, the creation of the modern state of Israel. So help us always to remember you are in charge no matter what the opposition throws at us. So help us to remember that in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.